States. So I do have a background in science. After that, we went to Indiana for graduate school. My husband got his PhD. I got a master's in education. Three of our four kids were born there. And then I've been not home since. So I've homeschooled on and off. These are my four children, all girls. Part of the reason that I've homeschooled this year, or the last few years, it's been very clear to me, and I'd be interested to know some of your reasons for homeschool. I think it's important that we have those clear reasons for those hard days. But for me, it's been twofold. One was just the time aspect. When my kids were in school and they were gone for such long periods of the day, it was really hard to, I feel like, to get them, you know, to teach them to work, to teach them to do music, to teach them to do all the cool things in this world, to gain their own experiences. And so it's really important that we have more time. And then the other reason that for me was a very individual reason for my kids, I have all girls, and they love to be good, right? They love to do what they're supposed to. And when they were in school, they would wait for the teacher to tell them what to do next. And they started getting this habit of just waiting and waiting. And so even at home, I found that they weren't taking initiative to go do whatever. They wanted me to tell them what to do. And I found, no, this is not actually a habit I'm okay with. This is something that, you know, I'm a firm believer that we need to, and 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, right? And this idea of being proactive and going and doing things, initiating things on your own is important. And so for me, that was a big reason for homeschooling. So along with that, I love it when my kids do things like this, right, where they get to make their, my daughter had this little crochet dragon, and she made her own little crocheted dress to dress up her daughter, her dragon. Or this, my daughter is doing iBob, she's doing the book, Battle of the Books is what it's called. And so she made this little basket for her book and her notebook and her cards, and she realized that it kept falling over when she put in just the book. And so she made these little side things to try to keep it sturdy. So now it's sturdy, right? This side, just thinking through how to make that work. Or cooking, now they have time to cook. Or to make these little sleds when it snows. You'll notice that my third child was the one who had to go down it, because when one of the bigger ones went up, they went up and over the edge. So they had some, there was some very important learning things there. Or this, a local school, one of the librarians at the local school contacted us, and she says, hey, the music teacher has these ukuleles and all of these little, I think they're called capstan washers or something like that, are broken. And in order for us to fix this, like, we have a 3D printer at the school, but how do we make this? And my husband has some experience with 3D printing, but he gave it to my 10-year-old daughter and said, here, make this. You can make this. This is easy. And so my 10-year-old daughter figured out how to make the little washer, and we sent the file off to the school, and now all 30 of their ukuleles work. They were very happy. And so the reason I share these things, because to me, and this partly is because of my science background, but science at its heart should be a problem-solving activity. Right? So all those examples, some of them are science-related, some of them are maybe harder to realize how they're related to science, but to me, the beauty of science is not necessarily the content, it's not necessarily the specific things you teach, but this idea that science is one of the ultimate places where we can problem-solve. Right? What makes someone a good scientist or a good engineer is not necessarily the content they know, although we'll talk about that. The content's important, but it's their ability to solve a problem that no one else has solved before, right? And that's what makes someone good at that. And so me, as a homeschooling parent, that gives me a lot of peace, because even though I have a science background, it's still kind of hard to teach science. It takes a lot of effort. It takes, I mean, there's lots of different resources, but I found them to be hit or miss. But when I think about science, teaching science as a problem-solving activity, that I want my kids to be able to take this knowledge and figure it out and to learn from it and to go solve problems, it gives me a lot more freedom to see what that science looks like. So I want you to think for a minute, what does science class look like in your home right now? Right? So for many homeschoolers, they'll outsource it. Maybe you outsource it to a co-op or online. Some people will read lots of books, watch movies, some skip it altogether. Some will just find random experiments. Maybe you have a book of experiments or something else, and you just find random experiments that you're doing. But what does science look like in your home right now? And I want to explore this idea of common pitfalls that come in teaching science. And as I go through, if you guys have questions, we can talk about it throughout, because I don't know that if I talk the whole time, it might not last the full 45 minutes. But these common pitfalls in teaching science are not just for homeschoolers. This is true, I would say, in school. This is true even when I got my degree at the university. This is true when professionals teach. This is just kind of a generic, this is how, in our society as a general, some of the problems that we have when we teach science. The first thing that we do most often is we love to show off. We love to show, look at how cool science can be, right? So when I was, my husband and I were dating, actually before we were dating, when we first met, we weren't dating at the time, but we met at the physics club. And our physics club would go to the local elementary schools all the time, and we would do cool science demos with the kids. And we had our Van de Graaff machine, which I'm going to use with the other kids later today, where the static electricity generator that would make the kids' hair stand up, and they thought that was so cool. Or we'd get out the liquid nitrogen, which would freeze a rose, and then you could smash the rose and it would shatter on the ground, and we're like, this is so cool. And the kids are like, whoa, this is so cool. But the problem is, no matter how many, I also love basketball, but no matter how many times I watch the Utah State Aggie basketball and they slam and they dunk the basketball, that doesn't give me confidence that I can go dunk the basketball. It's the same thing with science. No matter how many times we show off how cool science can be and we tell them all these things, it doesn't necessarily translate into confidence for them to be able to go and do science. And so this by itself is a great way to motivate. It's a great way to get them excited, but it doesn't necessarily translate straight into that kind of problem solving or that ability and that confidence that comes. So this has its own place, but by itself it's not enough. And lots of us know that. And so the next thing we say, okay, well, science should be hands-on. And I know science should be hands-on, so I'm going to get some science experiments. Most science experiments that you get will have very clear step-by-step instructions. And they'll say, okay, get a cup of cold water and pour it in a glass cup, and then get 3 drops of cold or a blue food coloring and drop it in, and then get a hot or a 1 cup of hot water and get 3 drops of red food coloring and drop it in. And you might do that, and you can go through that experiment. But I found that oftentimes in that, it's boring. It's like having my daughter play chess against my husband, and then me standing behind her and saying, okay, move the queen over here. Now move your pawn over here, and move your rook over here. And when I do that, she thinks, well, why am I here? Like, you don't need me. You already know what's going to happen. I'm not doing anything. And then I also find it stressful for mom, at least for me, because, like, shoot, I'm letting my kids do it, and now they just put 5 drops of food coloring in. Did I mess this up? Right? Like, did I screw up the experiment? Because I don't know enough. And so we have these step-by-step experiments, but it still doesn't lead to that deep understanding. And so then we say, okay, I know that doing an experiment is different from, doing a lab is different from, like, doing science. I understand that. And so we'll say, okay, I want my kid to actually do science, so we'll get them a 3D printer and say, okay, go figure something out. Or we'll get them a microscope and say, okay, what can you look at? And again, it's not bad. There's a place for it. But it's like putting a kid in front of a piano and saying, make music. And in order for a kid to actually make music, you can't just put them in front of a piano. There has to be some structure behind it, right? And the same thing is true for science, that you need some sort of structure, and somehow you have to find the balance between all of these things, but these are the most common things that happen in science, is usually fall into one of these 3 buckets. Either we're just telling them what to do, or we were just showing them, or just any time that we're showing off, or we're telling them exactly what to do, or we let them, but we give them so much freedom that they don't even know where to begin, right? They think, oh man, I don't even know where to start. The consequences of this are children who are intimidated by science. They think, man, I don't know that I can do this. Or they think that knowledge is more important than the process. Oftentimes they think that whatever your end result is, or the knowledge, the thing you're supposed to learn, what am I supposed to learn from this? And then they tuck it away and then it flees. Or often, and I think this is the one that's maybe most permanently damaging, is this idea that they're afraid to fail or to take time to figure it out. Right? Because if you have one solution you're supposed to get when you do this experiment, and if you did that experiment wrong, then all of a sudden you're like, well, what did I do wrong? Like, I can't do this. I'm not smart enough. And if you don't take, or I mean, if you, you don't allow them to take that time to figure it out, and they think that the knowledge is more important than the process, then they start thinking that they're afraid to fail. So I'll tell you a story, an example from our homeschooling experience. Last year, I knew I wanted to do biology with my kids. And I feel like I'm competent at science, but biology is not my strength. And so I wanted to find a good biology curriculum or that could guide me, kind of help me through it as I was teaching the kids. And so I did tons of research over the summer, and I was like looking at lots of different ones, and I found one that was supposed to be really good, had great reviews, had tons of labs, just was supposed to be awesome. And week one, we delved into what's biology, what's a living thing, was great. Week two, the very next week, we dove into cells. And the lab we did, day one of week two, is, okay, get out this clay and roll out red to a 2-inch cylinder. And then roll out some white, this is the mitochondria. And the mitochondria is the powerhouse of the cell, and this creates energy. Okay, now make a yellow square or rectangle about this big. And this is the endoplasmic reticulum. And the endoplasmic reticulum makes lipids. Okay, and I'm explaining this. I'm reading this to my kids. I mean, you can see they're 8, they're 7, and 9. And I've heard these words, but I don't remember. How many of you guys have heard these words? How many of you remember what they do? What it means? Yeah. Some of you find a mitochondrial powerhouse. Right? The nucleus is in there. Yeah, you can see the nucleus. I had to look. I mean, I've now heard this like in 4 different classes of biology classes and teaching it to my kids. This was last year, and in preparing this talk, I had to go look up and be like, I remember this is the mitochondria. What's this stuff? What's it do? I still don't remember. Right? And that's, my kids loved it. It shows off. This looked really good in their, you know, in the thing that we turned in. Right? It looked like we really did something awesome. And we did. The kids were excited. They were happy. And it was super stressful for me because I had different kids who were like, what do I do next? And I'm like, well, what did you just finish? Well, what's this mean? What does this do? And trying to keep up with all of them at the same time was like giving me a heart attack. It was so much work. And then the end was really cool. And then, okay, as I'm preparing this talk, and last week I made some, and my 10-year-old, she's like, huh, what's that? Like, you don't even remember, like, it's okay not to remember, but you don't need, like, that word doesn't even ring a bell? No, nothing.
Nothing.
So contrast that with, here's another experience. A couple years ago, as I was preparing, I don't know how many of you guys have seen, I'm in the vendor hall selling my circuit kits, and a couple years ago I was making these circuit kits, and these circuit kits are different from other science kits, because rather than telling you what to do, and I'll go into some of these details, and I'll actually talk a little bit more about it tomorrow in the Power of Play talk, but it uses challenges so that the kids are figuring out how things work on their own. So you start with one simple challenge, and then the challenges slowly get harder, and as they get harder, the kids are really having to figure things out on their own, and they start to internalize it a lot better. So this is them practicing the circuit kit and trying it for me as I was making it. Well, then again, as I was getting ready for this talk, so now 2 years later, we got this static electricity generator from a friend that I borrowed so that I could play with all the teenagers later today. And we were playing with it, and I had my daughter stand on it, and you could see her hair starting to go up, and I was asking about it. I says, well, why is your hair coming up? What do you guys think? What's going on here? And they, without skipping a beat, they used some of the wrong words, but they says, well, what's happening is that all the electrons, they actually said atoms, and I had to correct them. I says, well, it's not atoms, it's electrons. I'm like, all the electrons are coming up, and they're gathering on here. That's what static electricity is when the electrons move. They knew this. And he says, and what's happening when we're touching it is all the electrons then come into our hair, and electrons don't like each other because they're the same charge. He says, and so that's making it all stand away. And they were able to explain that to me in their own words on their own. And so you can see the difference between those two different methods of teaching. One, where you're focused on the knowledge and helping them cram as much as they can in. And the other, where you're focused on problem solving and learning the principles behind it. And even if we don't get all the words right, that'll come. But understanding these principles so that you can then understand what's happening around you. So the goal here is not simply science content, right? The goal is that your kids can figure things out when life throws challenges at them. Yep, that's the goal. So is science knowledge not important? And I don't want to say that at all. I don't want, because of course science knowledge is important. Right? I've been reading this book called Made to Stick by Peter Brown, and it's about how we learn as humans. It's really a fascinating book. But he says how mastery requires both the possession of ready knowledge and the conceptual understanding of how to use it. He gives an example of a person riding or flying an airplane. And he says, you know, the person flying the airplane, if something were to go wrong, they need to understand. I mean, he actually shares the story where someone, half the engine went out on their airplane, and he had to figure out how to land it safely. And he had to understand, you know, where's the gas coming from, what's happening, and I don't understand it well enough to communicate it very well. But as he, in his mind, he had to have all that knowledge. He had to have the mastery and the knowledge, and he had to be able to figure out what that meant to help me land safely, right? And those go hand in hand. You wouldn't want a doctor who can... Yeah, go ahead.
I just have a question.
Yeah.
So, would you, like, with what this is saying, how, like, you really need to be able to understand it before you would really want to start teaching the knowledge, would you recommend waiting to teach something like this out until they're older? Or how would you teach that in a way, like, how you... Versus how they did it?
It's a great question. If I were to redo my biology unit... I would have started with, or at least that unit, I would have started probably with, like, understanding the body first, or, like, what does someone need to live, right? And we actually talked about that, I guess, in week one. We talked about how, like, in order for something to be defined as a living thing, it moves, it, you know, excretes, it breathes, and it reproduces. I don't know, there's, like, six of them. And then I would talk about what do we need, or it needs energy, it takes in energy. Well, how do we get energy? And then I would talk about how, you know, in order for our body to get energy, we're made of cells. Well, the cells need energy, and this is where it comes from. And this is where, you know, and then we also need to be able to move, and this is where, you know, and so our proteins, the proteins are made in this part of the cell, and that's because that's what builds your muscles. And so I'd probably try to do it that way. But it's true. I don't know. I don't have a perfect example.
Like, would it make sense to wait until they're older to even teach something like the cell?
Probably. For me, at least the inside of the cell. I wouldn't bother teaching them the inside of the cell, but I think it's good to know, like, what a cell is, right? Yeah, it is common. Yeah, but I, if I were to redo it, I wouldn't bother about teaching them, what mitochondria and endoplasmic reticulum is. No, I don't think that the 6-year-old needs to understand that. Because we don't hardly understand that.
So I was going to say, I think that as you homeschool over the years, you're going to touch on those things several times. And so maybe throw out those words. Maybe teach what they do. But know that in 4 or 5 years, you're going to cycle back to it. And then they're going to understand it better. Even though they may not have really captured what you're talking about. They're going to get it again. And you're going to teach it a little bit more in depth.
And I think that's super valid, too. It doesn't mean that you totally ignore it. You can say it. But the idea, I mean, when they're little, the main idea is living things are made out of cells, right? And these are different parts
maybe,
that,
like,
cells are part of.
More
sure.
So than, like, this is the trash guy, and this is the, you know, use them in that direction instead of,
like, some
all, yeah, like, this is the protein guy, you know, like, they don't, maybe not, don't know that, but they do know what trash is. So
they know exactly.
That. So teach it in a... different way.
In a different way. No, that's a great insight, too. Is there another comment? Okay. Okay, so similarly, this idea of science content, I like to think of science content as being like your tools, right? The science content matters. They're your tools to then be able to solve a problem, right? Anyway, we've hashed this enough. I was going to say some other things that we've already talked about. So what can we do then? What does this mean kind of a little bit more practically for us as homeschooling parents? And so these are 3 principles that I use when I think about raising problem solvers, and I use this in my science class, and I also just use it in general. But these are kind of the 3 principles that I think are really powerful. And the first one is let them be the hero, right? This is about them. So, for example, here's 2 different science activities. This one's from a science, from a different electronics kit, where you can make a sound-activated switch. Look at how cool this is. And when you clap, the sound turns on. And when you clap, then the sound turns back off. And you just make this little diagram. And so the kids can put that together, right? Or can you make the light bulb light up? Let's start with this. You have a battery, you have a light bulb, you have a couple wires. Can you figure out how to make this light up? And you can see how the difference, one is getting them to be the hero, and this one, the kit's the hero, right? Look at this cool thing you can make. I created this art, and I look at what you can do, and they can do it, But the kit is the one that told them what to do it. The kit's the hero. Whereas here, when the kids are the ones who solve the problem and they get that light bulb to light up, oh, they get excited, right? And so you want to think about ways, how can I make it so that my kid is the hero? They're the one figuring something out or accomplishing something. And you do that by creating a goal. So if I get more, even more specific, so the goal is to, or you want to let them be the hero, and you do that by creating a goal. You create a challenge, you create a goal, you ask a question, and you let them be the one to solve it or to answer it. The second principle, we're going through this fast, so more questions, and we do have, I'll take one or two, but the second principle is you want them to discover through failure. So again, same thing. This is not one of my kits, but this is a kit I love. Here's the puzzle. Here's the problem. We can build these kits, and so you can see, be like, okay, we're trying to build this bridge. We're trying to get it across. Here's the puzzle. So they have to figure out how to build the bridge, right? Versus here, where it shows you how to build the bridge. And again, I'll show you. So this is my daughter figuring it out. Right. So she built this bridge. And it failed, right? It collapsed. And so then she had to figure out what to do. So she put it back together. She tried, kept it together. And I don't know how to pause it, but she's made this longer. As she made that a lot longer, she learned that it was sturdy enough to stay up. And so she was very excited about that. But that was all it took. She's just playing with some of these angles, some of these bigger things, and then was able to stay. This is called Bridge or Bust.
Bridge or Bust.
Bridge or Bust, yeah. Company's called Upper Story. They actually just came out with, we got it at Christmas, and that's like blowing my mind. I love it.
Can you keep reusing it? Like, can you do different designs?
Yeah. Yeah, so if I go back, yeah, this one, so it's all, it's ingenious. They use these little magnets and different pieces so that when it collapses, the magnets come apart, and then to reset it, you can see her just kind of put it back up and it resets so that the magnets attach back together, and then you can, anyway, keep making bridges.
What was the company's name again?
Upper Story.
Upper Story.
UPPER Story. Okay. Yeah. Bridge or Bust. So she saw, but she was able to learn again through that failure, right? So as it failed, and then she tried making that middle piece longer and was able to see how it was sturdy enough. That's all it took. And so they have tons of different bridges. I mean, they have a puzzle book of like 60 different puzzles. That the kids solve and figure out, and so we're slowly waking our way through it, and it's been really cool. And so this is related. This goes along with letting them be the hero and with letting them discover through failure. And that's this idea that you do not want to take away their moment of discovery, right? That moment of discovery, when they get so excited that they're the one that solved it, you don't want to take that away. So you have to be very careful that you don't jump in too fast. And so I'll share a little story about that. It's easy for me to say, let them figure it out, right? Sorry. It's easy to say, let them figure it out until they're the one actually failing, right? When they're about to fail, when they're about to mess up, and you're like, well, let me help you. It's really hard. I'll just do it for you. How does it feel when, you ask your six-year-old to wipe the table, you just had rice, and so you see your daughter, wiping off the table and just spilling all off the floor, and she's smearing the rice, and you're like, okay, this is not wiping the table. But if I'm the one who jumps in and then does it for her, how does she learn to wipe the table? And she learns to say, well, my efforts aren't good enough for mom, right? What I do isn't good enough for mom. There's a study that they did where they had these kids doing hard math problems that were outside of their ability. And these kids were doing these hard math problems, and they were struggling, and they couldn't quite figure it out, and they were monitoring their stress level. And the kids' stress level was elevated, but it also was manageable. They were doing okay, but it was hard. And then they measured stress levels of parents watching their kid do this hard math problem and doing it wrong. And the parents' stress levels just like skyrocketed. They were high. And oftentimes the parent would go step in and show them, like, okay, this is how you do it. And the moment that the parent stepped in, they saw the parent's stress level start to moderate because the parent was now working towards solving this problem. I have this problem. My daughter doesn't get it, But if I help you understand it, then we're working towards progress. But the moment mom stepped in, the child's stress level went through the roof because they're like, I can't do it. Mom's not stressing me. And they're not the one working through that process, right? And so one of the points of the study was when you're the one who's kind of the one and putting that effort in, that progress kind of stabilizes your stress level, right? And so it requires us as the parents to be adult enough to say, I can handle this high stress and I can let you work through it. And so it's as stressful as it is, letting them fail, letting them do it wrong is actually very important, right? So what does this mean for you? Well, it means hold your tongue. Don't jump in too fast. You need to give them permission to fail. That failure, that process, that's how they learn. This is good. This is important. And you let them discover through failure. Yep. So you let them be the hero. You want them to be the hero. You want to let them discover through failure. Number three is then you slowly increase the difficulty. Because oftentimes the question is, okay, they're failing, they're really not getting it. Do I just let them keep failing, or what do I do now? Right? And I'm sure we've all had this experience where it's like, okay, go tell your child to go clean their room. And they look at their room and they think, I don't know how to do this. Or they just get overwhelmed. Right? And I think most experienced parents understand that instead of telling your child to go clean the room, you break it up into smaller tasks. You say, okay, first I want you to make your bed. Second, I want you to pick up all the clothes. Then I want you to pick up all the books. And then once you break up the tasks, and then all of a sudden they say, oh, okay, I can do this. And that's the same principle whenever we're teaching a science class, whenever we're doing any sort of problem they're trying to solve. You give them a clear goal. You say, okay, I want you to wipe this table. You first wipe it into a pile, and then you wipe it into your hand. And you can break it up into smaller pieces and let them still be the hero. Let them still be the one that's figuring it out and failing without not being able to get to see the success as well, because that's where the motivation comes, is when they see success. So again, what does that look like? Well, when I teach science, I love to have these different levels of challenges. So we'll start with make a simple circuit. Let's make a game. Now can you make a game where the wire light only turns on when the wire touches? And it gets harder and harder. So then as you go through, they're figuring out how this works. And so I've done that. I tried it last year when I was teaching biology. We're learning about biomes and ecology, and I says, okay, so if we have this animal, this bunny, like, it needs a place to live. And so we talked about, so it's like, well, what does it need to live? And well, it needed food. So then we had to talk about, you know, where the food comes from, and then where, you know, it needs a place to hide. And so then we were able to talk about stuff, but we did it in terms of kind of asking these questions that got harder and harder, but that kind of helped give them a bigger picture, breaking that big task into smaller pieces. So when kids get stuck, the answer isn't necessarily more help. The goal, or what you want, is just a smaller goal. So that's what you're kind of trying to get to, is rather than just jumping in and giving them the answer, you want to give them smaller goals and just break that goal into smaller chunks. So again, break goals into smaller pieces. You can create these progressive challenges that build on itself so that they then can accomplish the whole goal. You're slowly increasing the difficulty, which then allows them to discover and to let them be the hero. So my final question then is, how are you going to inspire a problem solver this week? And that's really what I have, any questions. So I'd love to talk through with them with you guys questions you have, either about this or about the science that you're doing specifically, how to make this work a little bit more specifically. What kind of, where are you guys at? What problems are you facing? What do you have?
Siblings getting involved in problems.
Great question. Go ahead.
what's a good way, it's good because they're the older ones are learning, like they're teaching, mm-hmm. and they learn all that way. But also it's kind of robbing the younger ones, like being the hero of what they discover, right?
Yeah.
Do you, like when you're teaching, like, your science and stuff, or you, when you're kind of all together, mm-hmm. how do you keep the older ones from stealing the thunder of the little ones' discovery?
It's a great question. We talk a lot about, my kids, I'll tell my older ones, like, let them figure it out. Like, you loved figuring it out, let them figure it out. And they'll usually stop. The other thing is just letting the older kids go at a faster rate or giving them harder challenges than the younger ones. Because then they're still, because if they're figuring their own thing out, then they're not worried about the other child. And so, like, with the bridge game, for example, like, that one's been tough because it's hard for everyone to build the bridge at the same time because they have different ideas. But, like, we just kind of take turns, and then I say, no, you'll have your turn next. Like, we'll let you figure it out next. I don't know, any other insights? How else do you guys handle that? You may make it so that the big kids don't take up the thunder from the little kids. Yeah, go ahead.
I think you really have to just give people their own space and time. Like, mm-hmm. I think sometimes, because we have your electricity kit, and my kids loved it, but I did have my big kids do it later by themselves. Mm. Like, I just gave it to my older kids, and I'm like, hey, whereas my younger ones, I did it, like, with the ones that were, you know, the, like, two of them that were kind of the same level where they could work together. So I knew my older ones would jump in and be like, oh, no, this, you didn't get wrong, or whatever, you know, and so I just have them do it at different times, because I think that they're at different places in their understanding, right, and so they can't discover if they don't. If they're not allowed to.
Well, and I think that that's important because, like, with the bridge one, for example, again, I don't have any association. I just love that product. But, like, when my kids were doing it, my husband and I are not actually, we don't fully understand that realm, and we wanted to jump in because we didn't know yet, right? And so we wanted to also solve this problem. And so, like, there was a couple times where I said, Scott, we gotta, like, let them do it. We can do it after they go to bed. Like, we can solve this on our own. Right? Like,
we want to solve it too.
I know, like, we gotta wait. But I think that's part of it. Like, if they already know the answer, then it's easier for them to hold back. Or at least for me, if I already know the answer, I can hold back. But if I don't know the answer yet, then I want to solve with them, and then that often will take their thunder. And so I have to check myself in those situations.
I was gonna ask too, because I love everything you said here, but I am not a science person, and so the idea of actually thinking of somehow to implement this in my homeschool, like,
yeah,
to do it, like, and I liked your bunny idea, like, about, like, but I was just thinking, how would I practically, like, if I had a, like, for example, we just did the periodic table, and I was trying to think, like, how could I have done this idea with the periodic table? What would I, I just don't know where to even start, like, I don't know.
It's a great question, and I mean, because, like, this is something that's important to me, and I've thought through it a lot, and it still takes me a long time to do it this way, right? And I think that's important. And in some ways, if I'm totally honest, that's why I have a hard time sharing this message, because it is hard. And I want to, if I'm going to do it, I want to do it right, and I want to make it big and cool. And sometimes it's okay to just do it wrong, right? And just to say, you know what, we're just going to talk about the periodic table, and even though this is not the best way to do it, like, it's okay. Right? And like, that's where you start, right? And anyway, so there is that. But at the same time, if we can come up with challenges, with questions, it really does engage kids more, right? And so it really just comes with practice of, okay, I'm trying to teach periodic table, different elements. You know, what can we, I think one way to do it would be to be, and this is because of other things I've been doing, but I've been learning about, like, how we make batteries, for example. And, okay, random story time, science story time. The way we came up with batteries, or someone came up with batteries, he would take apart frogs. He would dissect frogs for a living. Well, he taught anatomy, and then he would dissect frogs as part of that. Well, at one point, and I don't know why, he had a couple of different metal pieces, and he would touch them to the frog, and the frog would jump. Now, this is a dead frog, and the frog's legs would jump. And he realized that living things have nerves and they use electricity, and that was kind of the beginning of that. But he also realized that part of that was just these two different metals. And so I am planning with my kids to experiment with different types of metals and see what makes the best kind of electricity. And you can see, you know, what takes electrons, what gives electrons, and you can see that through electricity. And so I think, like, for me, that would be one way to try to turn that into something. Now, without any background, that becomes extra. Like, it's hard enough for me, right? Without the background, it's, like, extra difficult. So I get it.
But maybe if I'm, like, looking for those opportunities, that kind of changes it too, right? Like,
that's exactly right.
Of, like, oh, like, I was just thinking my daughter was wanting to make, she's into making bread, right? So it's like, oh, well, what happens if you put it in cold water? What happens if you make bread differently? You know what I mean? Just asking her.
Exactly. No, that's exactly. Like, how do you get your like, you're bred to rise the best, right? Like, what can you do to make this rise differently? Like, because my daughter's been experimenting with bread. Last year, it was just flour and water, and she realized this does not make good bread. She also needed salt, and that she also needed, last week when she made it, she did add yeast, but she didn't wait for it to rise. And anyway, like, it just comes, right? And that's why I shared those examples at the beginning of things that really weren't even science-related. Kind of, right? Like, cooking, crocheting, sewing, you know, all of these things have these components of science and problem-solving in them. And really, that's the goal, right? Really, the goal is how can we help our kids practice problem-solving in any capacity, even cleaning their room, even thinking, okay, I'm struggling to get up on time every day. What can I do to help myself get up on time every day? Okay. So I think that's how it's just trying to find those ways to ask challenges and to give them opportunities to solve their own problems.
Another question. So have you found it's more effective to let them experiment first and then teach them the principles, or teach them the principles and then let them experiment?
So I like to, it's a great question. It depends, and I often go hand in hand. I think it's, if you have a clear goal, then I will often let them try to experiment with it and then teach what just happened. So, for example, with circuit kits, if the kids, I mean, the very first thing I tell them is, can you light up this light bulb? And if they're struggling, if they really have no clue, then I will teach the science and be like, okay, in order for electricity to flow, you need a circuit. Circuit comes from the word circle. So can you make a circuit or a circle with everything connected? And then that's usually enough for them to then figure out how to do it, right? And then we'd move on to the next level. And again, I would teach the science after they figured it out, if I can. But if not, then that science can often help push them over the edge to figure it out. But one thing that Make It Stick book, I quoted him earlier, one thing he talks about in that book is that in order for us to really learn something, we need to, or like, the more that we struggle with it, the more it's actually likely to stick. We feel the way we think we learn through reading, through hearing things, while it's not bad, it doesn't stick, and it feels like we're making lots of progress, but we're actually not. And he talks about how when things take a long time, when you have to struggle with it, and he uses math as an example, like if you're really struggling with this math and then you come, like you go and you do something else and you come back, eventually it starts to stick a lot better, and the more that you've struggled, like, the better you fully understand it. And that's been my experience with science as well, is like that failure, that struggling is not a bad thing. It's a sign that things are happening on a deeper level. And then once they get it, so oftentimes I'll find that the kids who take the longest to solve some of those first two levels, once they all of a sudden they get it, then they can fly through the rest. Whereas some kids, they'll stumble across the answer pretty fast with the first couple levels, and then they're struggling still by levels 4 and 5, and it's like, okay, we got to go back. Like, you really have to understand this basic part. And so sometimes that struggle is good. Does that answer your question?
I was just wondering, how do you personally balance science with the rest of your homeschool? Mm-hmm. Like, is it something you do every day, or?
I do it once a week, if
okay.
I'm honest.
Yeah.
But that once a week is, and sometimes it's once every 2 weeks. But I do try to incorporate these problem-solving activities in lots of different ways, right? So, like, does that answer your question?
Yeah.
So, like, we do these kind of science, or, like, I mean, lots of people love nature study. Nature study is a great way to do it, I mean, because there's often questions and things that come about from it. There's things that you can do to help with this problem solving, to help with scientific thinking, logic puzzles, math, all those kind of things are helpful in that regard. But, like, mm-hmm. official science we'll do once a week is
okay.
Probably pretty average.
So, when you did the
That's a fantastic prompt.
No, that's a really good prompt.
I was like, I don't care.
My prompts are not that detailed. That's a really good prompt. Anyway, go ahead.
It goes through and it gives me 10.
Yeah.
Like, here's one scenario. A body can't make enough enzymes to digest food properly, even though the instructions exist. It's a
go through, okay, here's the thing, okay, let's figure out which one of these structures is failing here, and anything gives you,
well, and it does, and I've used ChatGPT multiple times. It really does give you a great starting point.
So I feel like almost anything we do now can just be turned into a problem-solving scenario like this. Mm-hmm. Like, this is more of an intellectual way, but I feel like this
And that's very real. No, I actually love that. I think that's great advice, because I do use that as a stepping point, and then I'll use my own intuition. But it's a fantastic way to at least get you up over that hump of what are problems we can solve related to this, right?
And then also thinking about science literature. Mm-hmm. Like finding, there are so many books on like who discovered the structures of the cell, right? Just more modern things like evolution 2.0, where we're talking about DNA and where it's built. Just the more it becomes part of our vocabulary, the easier it
is. I agree. Yeah, no, thank you. Those are very important things. And tomorrow in my play, I'm going to talk about play, and it's a similar idea. Lots of the principles are the same, but we'll use lots of board games too. There's some great board games, evolution, biomes, cytosis. There's like some fun board games that help teach lots of these concepts too, and they automatically kind of incorporate those ideas in there. And so that's another way that's just really simple and easy, but then it becomes part of your vocabulary, and then it's not overwhelming when you start learning it at a deeper level. Okay.
Then
you can't think. Yep. Oh, there's lots of experienced parents here. Anyone else want to help answer that? No one's volunteering.
I'm just trying to think, what are my experiences? I would say, sometimes just take a break.
Yeah.
If they're really frustrated, then just be like, let's take a break for a while.
It goes back to making the problem smaller.
I think that's what it goes back to.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Did you hear that?
Yeah.
Yeah, making the problem smaller, sometimes taking a step back and then saying, we'll address it later. Like, it's okay to feel frustrated, and I think that's something I say a lot too. Like, it's okay to feel frustrated. I would feel frustrated too. But that doesn't mean that you can't do this. It just means that this is hard, and you'll figure it out.
And so, I was going to say that too. I have a little girl that she's a giver upper. Like, she just gives up when things are hard, you know? And there's some show on PBS Kids, I can't remember this, but when the little girl gets frustrated or upset, she flops. On the ground, and I found that really helps her. I'll say, do you need a flop? Yes, I just need a flop. And she'll still flop. And I'm like, are you done flopping? No, I need to flop again. And she'll flop a couple times, and then she'll come back. You know? So she just needs a emotional
release.
A release.
Probably particularly when you're little, just that movement.
A recognition that, wow, this is hard, and I need to start over. I don't know, right? It's like a reset for her.
Reset.
I don't know if that would work, but it really helps her.
Sometimes I tell my kids, run around the kitchen five times and then come back and see if you've reset. Get your body moving and your blood pumping and maybe a break.
And those are all very real things, right? Like the physical, right? Going back to biology, your physical body matters, movement matters, resetting, new spaces, that all helps. But yes, breaking it into smaller goals, saying frustration's okay, that doesn't mean that this is wrong. You can still figure this out. Hopefully that helps. Yeah. You let them be a hero in another way, and then they want to keep doing that, right? Yeah. Okay, I think it's time. So I'll let you guys go to your next classes. Thank you.